And the council agreed that it should be established. Ward gave $100 to take care of the paperwork, setting up the foundation with his legal firm. And you and Ward and I were the three incorporated. And it went on from there. I was the first secretary.
Well, you see, it can be successful, Virginia Tech.
What's that?
Virginia Tech has a foundation. It just collected $60 million.
Yeah.
Right off like that. Yeah. I mean, and their state supported. I don't know why it didn't take in my days.
Well, it takes a while to change people's thinking from support of private institutions to the concept of a public university's need outside of the state budget. Well, I think all you needed to do was have a list of, let's say, the 20 highest, most heavily endowed institutions in the country and see how many of them were state institutions. Mm-hmm. Take all the Midwestern institutions. Have very large endowments.
Yeah.
Texas, of course, is at the top, but in addition to Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, you've got Michigan, Illinois, Minnesota, Ohio State.
Well, I can't think of anything, Carl.
Anything else? All right. Well, thanks very much. Is Andy Anderson...
he's around.
He's around?
I'm sure you'll find it in the phone book. I don't know where his address, but he lives.
I thought that while I was here,
I
might call him and see if he would be free.
Yeah.
Well, thanks ever so much, George. This interview with George Collins ends at this point, and we will start the interview with R. Christian Anderson, former assistant director of the Brookhaven National Laboratory, and for 11 years on the council of the University at Stony Brook, and for 9 years chairman of that council. Bob, do you want, or Andy, do you want to start off with your memories of the times prior to your coming on the council, your memories of the early days at Stony Brook, as far as you can recall them?
Well, my view is that the early structure under John Toll deeply affected by the prior existence of Brookhaven National Laboratory. And early on, as assistant director at the lab, I was, I guess, the point man for contacts with the university, it being quite clear that there could be a synergistic effect between Stony Brook and Brookhaven. And I had no formal connections with the university in those days. I knew Sam Gould, and I had been at the original investiture, I think it was in Rockefeller Center, way, way back when, quite an elaborate ceremony, and had kept in informal contact with the university campus as it developed, because we wanted to exchange staff members, and I certainly wanted to help with students and the various informal programs. There was no, in my view, by the very fact that there were no formal arrangements, it allowed Stony Brook and Brookhaven to interact in ways which might have been prevented by some bureaucratic structure in existence already. It's pretty clear to me that moving Stony Brook to its present location and the early emphasis on science can be attributed to the proximity of the lab. In the history of science at the time, it was clear that that kind of interaction, universities and research centers, were the key to a whole bunch of politically sensitive ideas, brain drains for maximizing the public's investment in either research or education. And it's only in that informal sense did we have any kind of interaction at all. But it was close and deep and varied, and it was not at an administrative level for the most part. It was a faculty member and a lab research staff member interacting across the board. Now, the thing that helped Brookhaven, and this is a plus for Stony Brook, was that, as you're well aware, while the lab always had a very strong academic coloration, it could never aspire to the standards of the university by virtue of the narrowness of the disciplines it supported, which I, as an individual, sort of regretted. There were attempts to have a broadly based library at Brookhaven, but it could not support programs in the humanities or even philosophy, which might have bore on the kinds of things developed there. And so the growth of Stony Brook into an honest-to-God first-rate university was a welcome event. And how much the lab affected the coloration of the Stony Brook program would be hard to divine, except that I think it was very clear. The Stony Brook faculty recruitment probably was enhanced by the proximity of Brookhaven, especially for many members of the attracted to the science faculty. And one has to admit that right after the war, as against the present day, science was in the forefront of everybody's minds as to what the future might be, the endless frontier kind of thing. That's changed, that's all that it is. But Stony Brook grew up, as did in fact Brookhaven, in a post-war sense of euphoria about the power and even the majesty of intellectual activities, especially in science. Both Brookhaven and Stony Brook benefit from the fact that they were created after the Second World War under the then new conditions. And again, there are pluses and minuses to that. Stony Brook could develop as rapidly as it did, in the way that it did, because it had no depth to an academic past.
That's a good point.
It is a good point, in the sense that now it looks as if it's been there for a long time.
When were you first involved at Stony Brook?
Well, let's see, the lab was founded, as we've just been reminded, in 47. And Stony Brook, then what's interesting also in this history is to relate that the National Science Foundation came after that. And then I think about that time, Stony Brook, not Stony Brook, but the University Center on Long Island at Planning Fields, which is what you know better than I do, was in.
Well, the center actually started taking in students in the fall of 57.
Okay.
That was in Oyster Bay.
Right.
And then they moved out to Stony Brook in September of 62, and that's when I came.
Right. Well, okay, so then I've been involved, as I said earlier, with the University Center only after it had been transplanted to Melville today.
Right.
And again, it's my view that locating it there is probably superficially attached to the rather generous grant of land by Melville, but I think in the minds of certain of the major participants, being closer to the lab was a key to that move, and it's my view that Melville had never in his wildest dreams an idea that the thing would become a large university or one devoted to science. I think that's fair to say.
He was given, in 57, he was the first Suffolk resident given the award by the Long Island Daily Press then as distinguished citizen. That was in September of 57. And he gave quite a speech, primarily interested in the economics of public education, which indicated that one reason he'd given the land was to protect the Three Village area from the encroachment of developers.
Well, that's good. You either build a university or a cemetery. Let me tell a story here because it's only slightly germane, but it adds a little color to these things. About that time, a little after, say, 3 or 4 or 5 years after that, I was sent to New Zealand on a scientific mission in Jerry Tate's stead, who got stuck with some Martian pony and thing. We were asked to go to New Zealand to advise the government on the brain drain. They felt keenly that their best young people were going overseas to do their science. And we were shown with due reverence Rutherford Diggs of Canterbury, because that's where Ernest Rutherford was born and educated and raised, and he had to leave, as did many people afterwards, to do any science. They were trying to...
I didn't know he was a New Zealander.
Oh, he's a New Zealander.
Is that right?
Oh, that's very important. As a matter of fact, so was Marsden. I met Marsden when I was there on this thing. And we were treated royally, which, of course, in New Zealand means something because they're more for the Queen than the Englanders are. But anyway, we went on the South Island and we were driven by chauffeured limousines all over the Bronx. Saw all the university centers, and I was the one to speak about the relation of universities to industrial or other research institutions, and they were unfortunately, as they were in England at the time, loath to see the connection between research and university education. Strange.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we would stop at various places, scenic places along the way, and would sign in that we were there. So they told, they were asked to do that because this was a high-level thing, and people followed us all over the place, reporters tagging along and so forth. Got to Queenstown, which was about as far south on the South Island as we were going to go. And we were in the lounge having a drink. And someone said, "Are you Dr. Anderson?" And I said, "Yes." And they said, "There's a lady and gentleman that want to meet you." So I went over to them, and it turned out to be the Melvilles.
Heaven's sake.
Now, at that point, I had never met either of them. And they were on a private trip of their own with several aides.
Remember what year this was?
Well, I'll resurrect it now that we've talked about this. Fantastic, absolutely fantastic that the whole thing comes together something like 7,000 miles away. We had a very pleasant chat, and I said who I was and where I was from. And they didn't know that. All they knew that there was a Dr. Anderson from Brookhaven, New York, as part of this other group. They had read the legacy.
Uh-huh.
We had a great talk, and then of course I've met them subsequently on several times, mostly ceremonial, because we had no social connection. But I thought that was, it tied so many things together about my interest in Stony Brook and what was developing there, the connection between the two, which I must say the Melvilles couldn't comprehend and really weren't interested in, but nevertheless, this sort of thing happened. Incredible.
Yeah. About.
I'll get you a date, because it would be of interest here, because after that, it seems to me the Melvilles, as they must necessarily have been, they different things he did. Anyway, the other connection with Stony Brook in those days was that I would be occasionally called to Albany for some sorts of meeting. As a matter of fact, I was a member of a committee that was appointed by Rockefeller to look at research and development in the state of New York, and I would have to get out my papers on this thing. And it was at that time that there were discussions about the growing importance of Stony Brook and methods by which it would be further strengthened. But like most gubernatorial commissions, very little came of it.
Why, you know?
Well, in my view, most governors, and I don't care, in most governors in the state of New York, always have a larger view than just the state, which puts the state at a disadvantage. Now, Mario Cuomo, I think quite clearly, is looking down the road. I think FDR did. Harriman was already an internationalist, so it didn't make much difference. But on this point, while I'm on it, the thing that I think quite bluntly affects the university's fortunes now is that we have a string of Democratic governors who resent the fact that the university was created, along with a number of other things, like the Albany Mall, by a Republican, and a Republican who was neither fish nor fowl in a political sense. He was disavowed by his Republican friends nationally, and in that sense did not have the kind of clout, despite his Oedipus complex, that could have created a university a la Minnesota, a statutory university, rather than a departmental part of the government, because I think that's, in my view, the key to the weakness of SUNY and has an enormous effect on the fortunes of Stony Brook.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
Right.
Absolutely ridiculous.
I've just been to San Diego, University of San Diego.
Right.
It's quite a difference.
Yeah. When we were trying to recruit to replace Johnny Till, we had a couple of beautiful people in our sights who came here, who looked at that thing and said, no way. Now, if we had had the same structure as California, we would have some of the very best people in the country, in the SUNY system, and at Stony Brook, on that one issue. And they were right. They were right.
Sure.
Now, how are we going to convince Albany, whoever the hell they are, that this is insane? It's not a matter of money. I still insist that for 10% less, if Stony Brook could manage that money, we would be that much better off.
Sure.
Well, anyway, but no, this kind of argument ought to be on the record. Somebody ought to be saying what you don't say in Albany because it's politically... even my daughter says, you don't want to fight Cuomo. Well, I'm not really fighting Cuomo, but I'm fighting the system that Cuomo is brilliantly exploiting. The other person I still, I'm trying to remember his name, he's like I was in the school.
So,
yeah. Because think of the good people that were once in the SUNY system that left for other places out of sheer disgust and dismay and frustration. Pellegrino is a good example of any. Now, these people are not ne'er-do-wells or soreheads. I mean, these are distinguished people, and the state lost them. And unfortunately, Stony Brook is a good example of the baleful effects of that.
Yeah.
Now, again, I'll put it on the record, is Johnny Toll probably had expended all his political capital and his psychic energy on getting Stony Brook to the point it was when he was lured away. So I don't take it in that specific instance to have been a tragedy to have lost Johnny. we needed a sort of consolidation of what was an enormously fruitful growth, but it had to settle down because even I was dismayed at some of the disjunctions at the university then.
We're still going.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, you remember as well as I do.
Go ahead.
I.I. Robbie made one point about Brookhaven, which, of course, fails in the long term, but which I used to feebly argue with Haywood about, that for even scientists, they need an atmosphere which is aesthetically pleasing. And of course, Brookhaven has no aesthetics at all. And the failure at Stony Brook was the same thing. It is now a campus, but it could have been done much better with the same amount of money. But you had bureaucratic intervention in the creation of the buildings. Again, another fault that can be put back that it was not statutory, and therefore you had another part of the government saying, how we build buildings, we must make them look like prisons. And you can't have that. I'm sorry. It won't work. It doesn't work.
All right. I'm going to change the record.